Does Fricadella have the, oh, here it comes. All right, we're ready to go back onto the record here. First, I want to note for council, I was just passed on an item of information. This applies to today only, but today we are definitely going to need to end at 6 p.m. because the power in the building is going off at that time. So, on other days that will not be the case, but today we need to get done by 6, so plan accordingly. We can go from now until then. So for the respondent, you have any cross examination for this witness?
Yes, I do.
Ms. Rickardella, please go ahead.
You're a partner with Andrew Wakefield at Thoughtful House Center for Children in Austin, Texas, is that correct?
I'm not a partner there, no.
What do you do there?
I'm the director of gastroenterology services at Thoughtful House.
So are you Dr. Wakefield's employee?
No, he's not an employer.
Is that a partnership?
No.
What is it?
It's a working association. I don't own any share of Thoughtful House, nor am I employed by them.
Would you consider yourself a colleague of Dr. Wakefield at Thoughtful House?
Yes.
And you're the director of gastroenterology services at Thoughtful House, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, Dr. Thoughtful House posts on its website a page entitled Treatment at Thoughtful House. Are you familiar with that page? We'll put it on the screen.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Thoughtful House posts on its website a page called Treatment at Thoughtful House.
Okay.
Are you familiar with this page of Thoughtful House's website?
Not offhand, but I'll be happy to look at it.
Do you recall, do you know who wrote this page?
I would not know who authored it, no.
You do not?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Is this filed in evidence?
No, it's not.
Could we have a copy of it, please?
Sure. If you look on the screen, there's a section entitled Medical Treatment. Do you see that section? We'll blow it up for you.
Okay, thanks.
And the first sentence begins with the sentence, children with childhood developmental disorders have dysregulated immune systems. Do you, in your opinion, believe that all children with developmental disorders have dysregulated immune systems?
All children? It's unlikely that every single child with autism would have that.
I didn't hear the first
one. It's unlikely that every child with autism would have a dysregulated immune system.
What about?
If that's the case in all of them.
Okay. Do you think the majority of children with developmental disorders have dysregulated immune systems?
My understanding that a number of studies have demonstrated immune dysregulation in children with autism that differs statistically from those without autism.
And what studies were those?
I can't cite them, but there's a good review on this by Dr. Paul Ashwood that might be cited in my report. He has a very excellent review article in the last 2 years of the immunologic dysregulations of autism, review of all previous publications.
And what about childhood developmental disorders other than autism? Do you believe that the majority of those are caused by dysregulated immune systems?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Childhood developmental disorders other than autism. Do you believe that those, too, are caused by dysregulated immune systems?
I have no knowledge of that.
And doctor, there's another phrase under the section medical treatment that states, treatment directed at correcting immune system abnormalities is imperative. In your opinion, should all children with developmental disorders, or particularly autism, receive treatment directed at their immune system?
I think that it's appropriate to focus on the immune system of these children. My direct knowledge of that comes from my own experience. The bowel disease that I have described this morning, this afternoon, is an example of a dysregulated immune system. So certainly to have a theory that you want a direct treatment at immune dysregulation is not something that is not without foundation or support.
But do you believe that the majority of children with autism should receive treatment for a dysregulated immune system?
And that a workup needs to be done to determine if there is an immune dysregulation or if a clinical observation warrants it. That's where it would have to start.
And doctor, when you say a workup needs to be done to determine if there's an immune dysregulation, how would a workup determine a immune dysregulation? What do you mean?
Those questions are best referred to immunologists to determine the specific immunologic aberrations that one might want to look for. But again, you know, there have been a number of studies that have demonstrated that this exists in these children.
Now, doctor, on this same page, there's a section entitled gastrointestinal diagnosis and treatment. Do you see that? What we've just blown up?
Yes.
Did you write this section?
Either wrote it or was consulted on it.
But as director of gastrointestinal services there, you endorse this section of the website?
I would.
Okay.
This particular part will be blowing up now, I endorse, yep.
Okay. Now, doctor, there's a sentence on this in this section that says, many children with CDDs have GI symptoms that precede, coincide with, or appear after the onset of neurological symptoms or regression. A child should produce one formed stool per day. Anything else merits attention. Doctor, in your opinion, is failure to form one stool a day a significant GI symptom in an autistic child?
No, what this paragraph says is it merits attention. What that means is that when you have, being that we know that these children so frequently have GI symptoms that are intense, and they have findings, both laboratory findings and on biopsy, when you have something that might deviate from a simple one stool per day, you need to direct attention to that and get a more thorough history. This paragraph does not suggest that if you don't have one bowel movement a day, there's something pathologically wrong with your bowel. That's a misreading of this paragraph.
And doctor, the section ends with the sentence, there is also a subgroup of autistic children that appear to lack GI symptoms, but without endoscopy evaluation, the question of an occult or hidden GI inflammation remains unanswered.
That's correct.
Now, does that mean that for proper diagnosis and treatment of this subgroup of autistic children who do not have GI symptoms, that they should undergo endoscopy evaluation to evaluate?
No, it does not mean that.
What does it mean?
It means that it is our suspicion that there is a bowel disease that is occult, meaning that it may not produce overt symptoms, particularly in this group of children who can't manifest or demonstrate pain. So that, for example, the presentation of the bowel inflammation I spoke about earlier could be just abdominal pain. Crohn's disease, the most frequent presenting symptom is abdominal pain. Even in the absence of any other symptom, abdominal pain is known to be a presenting symptom by itself in isolation of Crohn's disease. This particular group of patients represents a very unique problem in interpreting conventional symptoms, because whereas as pediatricians we're trained to observe certain behavior patterns or rely on what a child says, in these children, we haven't got the ability to do that because they don't manifest pain. they don't say it. They don't, often don't talk. And when they do have pain, they often manifest it in strange ways, like putting pressure on their belly instead of just putting their hand on it. For some reason, this is a behavior that some of them do. They lean over tables. And why would they do that? I don't know.
So, Doctor, are you saying, though, in this phrase, that children who do not manifest, autistic children who do not have GI symptoms may nevertheless have inflammation, but there's no way to know that unless the inflammation is confirmed by endoscopy?
Right, but that does not suggest that they therefore should undergo what the statement, what the sentence that you're highlighting is saying, is that there are a subgroup of patients who would not manifest overt symptoms, but overt symptoms are obvious, for example, abdominal pain, like I just said. And the only way to do that is to have a high index of suspicion, so that if you would see a child who's excessively irritable, for example, and that's the only symptom that you can tell that's relatable to the GI tract, even though he may be irritable for a whole variety of reasons, that one must take that seriously, because that may be the only indication of an underlying bowel pathology.
Now, Doctor, you were an attending physician at Lenox Hill Hospital from September 2000 through December 2004, is that correct?
That's correct.
And is it true that before you resigned your position, the hospital restricted your privileges to conduct endoscopies?
No, it's not correct.
What's incorrect about that statement?
I didn't resign my position, number one.
But why did you leave?
I did not renew my application for appointment there. Every 2 years, you need to renew it. And I chose not to renew it at the end of 2004.
Well, during your tenure at Lenox Hill, is it true that the hospital at one point did restrict your privileges to conduct endoscopies?
That's not the hospital's position. The hospital maintains that they did not in any way curtail my privileges.
Well, you sued the hospital, didn't you?
I did. One of
the reasons that you sued the hospital was because you thought that they had illegally restricted your privileges to conduct endoscopies.
Right, I claim that's correct. My claim was that they curtailed my privileges, and the hospital's position was that they did not.
Well, you thought that, regardless, they were concerned that you were conducting endoscopies on children, particularly autistic children, without medical necessity. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. They were concerned that that the colonoscopies that were being performed in these children did not have proper indications for colonoscopy.
And Doctor, you're licensed to practice medicine in Texas as well as New York and Florida, correct?
That's correct.
And in August 2005, is it true that you were fined $5,000 by the Texas State Board of Medical Examiners for misconduct?
That's not correct.
What's incorrect about that?
There was no misconduct.
Did you pay a $5,000 fine?
We did.
What was it for?
The fine was levied at, the reason for the fine was because the Thoughtful House website, before I was licensed, stated that Thoughtful House was open and patients can call. That's what the substance of the website said. It gave no suggestion that I was seeing patients, because I wasn't licensed. We didn't even know when the license would be coming, because it was a very long process to get licensed in Texas. But because Thoughtful House on their website represented that they were open, the understanding of the Texas Medical Board was that I was Thoughtful House and that I was open, and that indicated that I was available to see patients, and that they considered to be misrepresentation since I was not yet licensed. So they levied the fine of $5,000, which we chose to pay.
Doctor, was your fine in Texas also due to the fact that you did not report the Lenox Hill disciplinary action against you?
That is not correct.
Doctor, the minutes from your August 25th, 2005 application to obtain a license in Texas are public, and we have a copy which we'll put on the screen and we'll hand to counsel.
Thank you.
we've just put on the screen reflects that a motion was made to allow you licensure in Texas if you would pay a $5,000 fine due to disciplinary action by Lenox Hill Hospital, falsification of application regarding non-disciplinary citation by Florida, and misrepresentation regarding entitlement to practice medicine. And that was the motion that eventually passed to allow you to obtain your license to practice medicine in Texas. Is that not correct?
This did not. No, this did not pass, number one. And number two, this was not the way it ended up. I did not have to withdraw my application. The application was never withdrawn. It was the initial one was submitted and it went through. The other thing you asked before that was incorrect is that the question you asked me was, isn't it true that this website demonstrates that I did not disclose the Lenox Hill dispute to Texas Medical Board? That was the content of your question, and my answer is that that is completely incorrect. I disclosed that in its entirety in my application and made no effort in any way to avoid dealing with this issue in my application for Texas medical licensure.
Thanks, Amy. Doctor, your CV states that you're a clinical assistant professor at New York University. Is that correct?
Correct.
Are you currently on staff there?
Correct.
When was the last time you taught a class at NYU?
I haven't taught there.
You've never taught a class at NYU?
No. I'm on staff there.
Are you salaried?
From NYU?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Have you ever been salaried in NYU?
No.
Now, Doctor, on page 3 of your CV, you have an entry entitled Publications, and you have 4 listings. And for the record, I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 60. And under the first listing is entitled Suction Rectal Biopsy in the Diagnosis of Hirschsprung's Disease and Comparison of 2 Biopsy Devices.
Right.
And you state that you submitted this paper to the American Board of Pediatrics on April 20, 1995, about 12 years ago, is that correct?
That's correct.
What do you mean by you submitted the paper to the American Board of Pediatrics?
By submitted means that back in 1995, the requirement for completion and certification of pediatric gastroenterology training was that you had to submit a research paper to the American Board of Pediatrics. It actually is a misnomer to label it under publication, since in fact it does not end up being published. But what it was a review and a paper and a discussion describing exactly what the title says that was submitted to them for their review and to determine if this met the criteria to grant me certification in pediatric gastroenterology.
You say, though, it has not been published?
No.
Okay. Now, the second listing is a paper that you have published, you co-authored, entitled Laryngeal Dysfunction, a Common Cause of Respiratory Distress, Often Misdiagnosed as Asthma and Responsive to Anti-Reflux Therapy. That has been published in 2002, is that correct?
That's correct.
And the third listing you term a slide presentation that you presented at IMFAR, the International Meeting for Autism Research, in 2004. Now, Doctor, I note, though, that this slide presentation you also have listed under speaking engagements on page 4 of your CV.
That's correct.
Was this a speaking engagement or a publication?
Speaking engagement. This is not a publication.
Okay.
You are correct.
And the fourth listing you term a poster presentation at IMFAR in 2006, and I believe that's what you were just testifying to during your direct examination. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And that's a poster that described the preliminary results of a study you're doing with Dr. Stephen Walker and Dr. Karen Heppner?
That's correct. Okay.
And this has not been published anywhere, though, has it, Doctor?
That's correct.
Okay. So, among your 4 listings under publications, it's only the second listing that is a true publication, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, Doctor, you served as an expert witness for the claimants in the MMR litigation in the United Kingdom, is that correct?
Yes.
And we offered as an expert in that litigation as someone who is able to confirm intestinal inflammation in autistic children?
Yes.
Did you perform any endoscopies on those children?
On which children?
The children, any of the children that were the claimants in the United Kingdom litigation.
I don't know if any of my patients were claimants. I don't know that.
Now, in addition to your practice at Thoughtful House, you have a medical practice in New York, is that correct?
Correct.
And I was unclear during your direct testimony, are you still practicing general pediatrics?
No, I stopped that 3 years ago.
And you first met Michelle Cedillo in September 2003 when her parents brought her to New York to see you, is that correct?
Correct.
Now, Doctor, you wrote a report in this case dated February 4, 2007, which has been filed as Petitioner's Exhibit 59. We'll go ahead and hand you a copy of your report for you to refer to. Do you recall writing this report?
I do.
And on page 2 of your report, you state that about Michelle, her gross motor, fine motor, behavioral and emotional development proceeded in an age-appropriate manner during the first year, as evident by the pediatrician's notes and home videos. Doctor, what enables you to assess whether or not Michelle was developing in an age-appropriate manner during her first year of life?
This is the history that I obtained. So this information is from the history that one usually gets when encountering a patient for the first time.
And what type of history did you get? Let me rephrase that. History from whom?
This came from Mrs. Cedillo.
Did you review all the medical records in this case?
I don't think I reviewed all of them. I reviewed my entire medical chart. Perhaps some of the hospital records when she was hospitalized in Yuma. But in general, my charts, Teresa and I have an ongoing relationship, and she pretty much sends me everything that
Now, Doctor, is it your understanding after reviewing the medical records that Michelle's GI symptoms that developed following her second bout of fever continued to worsen over the ensuing months?
That's my understanding. That's correct.
Do you have an understanding of how long those GI symptoms lasted?
It was really the vomiting lasted for like 10 weeks or 11 weeks or 12 weeks or thereabout. It sort of tapered off. This is again by the history that I got. I didn't know Michelle at that point. The history that I obtained was that the diarrhea lasted for a good year or two, and then became constipation, primarily constipation, difficulty stooling. That lasted for about another year or two again. I have to look at the exact records. And then the diarrhea started again, and it's persisted since then. So it's been many years now where the only symptom has been diarrhea.
Now, Doctor, you first met Teresa Cedillo at a DAN, a Defeat Autism Now conference in October 2002, is that correct?
Yes.
Do you remember speaking with her about Michelle at that time?
Yes, I did.
Was that the first time that you had a discussion with Mrs. Cedillo about Michelle?
Yeah, I hadn't met her before that.
So. That was the first time you met her, okay.
Yeah.
Now, sometime, Doctor, before January 15th of 2003, you told Mrs. Cedillo that it was your recommendation that Michelle undergo another endoscopy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What was your recommendation based on?
I stated before that in the 6 months preceding the time that I met Michelle in September of 2003, her condition considerably worsened. Specifically, she had lost 20 pounds in the preceding 6 months. she had worsening of her diarrhea in terms of the number of stools per day and also the consistency of the stool. Her degree of abdominal pain worsened, so it was much more irritable and much more self-abusive, and her arthritis had worsened as well. So the overall downturn in her clinical condition, coupled with the fact that the January of 2002 colonoscopy was normal, made me want to search for an inflammatory origin of her symptoms, and that would require getting a biopsy.
Now, Doctor, do you recall that Michelle was hospitalized for dehydration on May 17th of 2003?
I hadn't met her yet, but that's the history that I got.
And Doctor, at this time, Michelle's treating gastroenterologist, Doctor, I'm not sure the pronunciation, Montes, did not want to perform another endoscopy on Michelle. Isn't that correct?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 28 at 51, which we'll put on the screen, Mrs. Cedillo sent you an email, and she told you that Dr. Montes told her that Michelle's problem in his of not eating and drinking, in his opinion, was behavioral in nature and not a gastro one, correct? Do you recall this, receiving this email?
I don't recall it, but obviously, I received this, I'll be happy to read it now. Can you just magnify it again? Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, I read it.
Okay. But you didn't agree with that, Doctor, did you? Because on May 19th of 2003, you responded to Mrs. Cedillo. And we'll put that up. If you can't find a GI to explore her for GI problems, then you could find a DAN doc near you who could treat her empirically for suspected enterocolitis with anti-inflammatories or steroids. Do you recall writing that email?
I do.
Okay. And Doctor, by Dan Doc, you mean a doctor who's part of the Defeat Autism Now? And
well, it's not quite part of it, but what I would mean by that is a physician who embraces the notion that autistic children with GI symptoms very frequently have a medical condition that's responsible for those conditions.
And what did you mean by recommending that she find someone to treat Michelle empirically with anti-inflammatories?
Well, what happens is the story that Teresa had told me was my experience, because I already seen so many of these children by this time. It was entirely consistent with well over 100 children that I had seen and endoscope and biopsy until then. So in my mind, there's very little doubt that even then, even never having seen her, it was very just the story, the presentation, there's very little doubt in my mind. Coupled with her labs, that she had an enterocolitis, and the best way to approach that would be to get a biopsy. There's no question about it. But in the absence of that, if you just can't do it, if no one seems to see it that way in Yuma, or if she physically can't get to one because of other medical reasons. If the biopsy could not be done to confirm the diagnosis, at that point it becomes appropriate to treat empirically. Empirically means you make the assumption, based upon your knowledge and experience, that this diagnosis is the most likely one. You treat accordingly. Good physicians tend to avoid treating empirically because that tends to obscure some of the findings that you otherwise could get, and it would leave questions that potentially could be answered, unanswerable. So you really avoid doing that whenever possible, but if the situation doesn't allow for any alternative, then empiric therapy is accepted.
Doctor, further in the same email, you state that you would be available to be a sounding board to another physician so long as that person was responsible and the prescribing physician. Do you recall writing that?
Yeah.
Now, doctor, the next day on May 20th...
I didn't quite say as long as they were responsible. I was like a misquote from what I wrote.
As the responsible and prescribing physician...
As they are the responsible physician, not that their character is responsible, but in other words, they're certainly responsible for the care of the patient.
Okay. Now, on the next day, on May 20th of 2003, Mrs. Sedillo wrote you back an email, and I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 28 at 107. And she stated that she had been talking to Dr. Cindy Schneider in Phoenix, who herself was a parent of two autistic children. And that she says, I quote, "She's not a gastro, so unable to scope, but very willing to prescribe, help in any way." Doctor, did you ever have a conversation with Dr. Schneider about Michelle?
I don't recall ever speaking with Dr. Schneider about Michelle.
At that time, doctor, in May of 2003, did you ever recommend to another physician that he or she prescribe anti-inflammatories or steroids to Michelle?
I don't think so. I don't recall telling any physician or speaking with any of her physicians at that point.
Now, doctor, on July 10th of 2003, you wrote a letter addressed to whom it may concern, and I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 28 at 84. And in the letter you state, "Over the past 6 months, her," meaning Michelle, "her inflammatory bowel condition has worsened to the point of requiring hospitalization for severe dehydration and malnutrition." Do you recall writing this letter?
Yes, I do.
And in the letter you further state, "I am only one of three pediatric gastroenterologists in the United States with significant experience in diagnosing and providing appropriate treatment for children with autism and this particular form of inflammatory bowel disease that is somehow associated with autism." Now, you made the statement about Michelle having inflammatory bowel disease to such an extent that it required hospitalization before you'd even met her, correct?
That's correct.
And doctor, when you refer to this particular form of inflammatory bowel disease, are you referring to autistic enterocolitis?
I am.
Now, doctor, you wrote another letter on August 5th of 2005 addressed to whom it may concern. And I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 28 at 73. And you state in the letter that Michelle needs a colonoscopy and upper endoscopy. And you further state that only two individuals in this country have any experience in the colonoscopic findings in children with autism.
That's correct.
Now, doctor, on July 10th, you were one of three people who had the requisite experience. But now August 5th, you're one of two. Who was the third? What happened to him?
That may have been a mistake. Tell me the years again of these letters.
2003.
I know that the other person with experience with these children have scoped a large number of them is Dr. Tim Bowie at Mass General in Boston.
Whose name was that?
Timothy Bowie, B-U-I-E. He's another pediatric generologist who has a specific interest in the bowel disease of these children.
And he's at Mass General?
He's at Mass General. The only other physician in the country who's, I don't know why I wrote three and then two, but there are, at least at the time of writing this letter, the only other person who had expressed an interest and I've spoken to in looking into these children is Dr. Michael Hart, who I spoke to on the phone. I'm pretty sure I'd spoken with him by then, and he had expressed interest in looking at these kids and taking their symptoms seriously as a sign of potential bowel disease and of having a lower threshold, perhaps, to make a diagnostic biopsy, to have a high index of suspicion of an underlying bowel inflammation. He expressed also a desire to do formal research in this area.
And where does Dr. Hart practice?
He is in Virginia. I don't recall the name of the hospital.
Now, Doctor, you first saw Michelle, I believe you testified, in New York.
No, I should mention that. That's right, that Dr. Hart has collaborated with Dr. Wakefield in gathering data on these patients. And the work has not yet been published, but I know that the data has been gathered.
Are Dr. Hart and Dr. Wakefield working on a study?
Yes.
Do you know, have they submitted it for publication?
I do not know if it's been submitted. I was not part of that study.
Okay. Now, Doctor, you first saw Michelle in New York in September 2003. I believe that's been your testimony, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And on September 25th of 2003, you performed an upper and lower endoscopy on her, correct?
That's correct.
And in the results of the study, in the results of the endoscopy, you found lymphonodularity and aphthous ulcerations, correct?
That's correct.
And that, you believe, is evidence of inflammation of her bowel, specifically inflammatory bowel disease?
That is partial evidence, that's correct.
And following the September 25th, 2003 endoscopy, you described two anti-inflammatories. One was prednisone, is that correct?
Correct.
And what is the other one? I didn't catch that.
There were three, actually, not two.
Oh, three. Okay. What are the three anti-inflammatories you prescribed?
Prednisone, as you mentioned, 6-MP, and sulfasalazine.
Okay. Now, Doctor, following the September 25th, 2003 endoscopy, did you believe Michelle had Crohn's disease?
No, I did not think it was Crohn's disease. If asked to label it, I sort of refrained from giving it a label because I didn't know what label to give it. It was bowel. It was a nonspecific enterocolitis of the kind that we see in autistic children. That's the most specific I can be, autistic enterocolitis. It didn't have, at that point, I didn't feel that I had evidence of the characteristic features that would enable me to label it as Crohn's disease.
Okay. Well, Doctor, on November 23rd of 2003, you wrote another letter to whom it may concern, and I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 28 at 424, and you state, as part of Michelle's Crohn's disease, she appears to have uveitis. Well, why did you think on November 23rd of 2003 that she had Crohn's disease?
I don't know. I may have been nonspecific in my terminology.
But it's your opinion, Doctor, that she has Crohn's disease today?
Yeah. What convinced me of that, beyond any question, was the PillCam study. You know, and again, beforehand, I would be hesitant to label it as Crohn's disease for the reasons I said. So whether, in my mind, whether you call it indeterminate colitis, Crohn's disease, or autistic enterocolitis, from a treatment standpoint, it makes no difference. The treatment approach would be the same.
Now, I believe, actually, you wrote about that in a letter dated May 4th of 2005. I'm referring to Petitioner's Exhibit 28 at 679. And you state there are many clinical similarities between autistic enterocolitis and Crohn's disease, but they clearly seem to be two separate entities at this point. However, the treatment options are the same for both. And how are the treatment options the same for both?
Well, really, what you want to do is you want to decrease the level of inflammation by using anti-inflammatories. That's one large conceptual approach. The choices of drugs are many. But to reduce bowel inflammation using drugs that are designed to do that is one approach. And the second approach is nutritional, giving enteral feedings. So the approach to treating Crohn's disease encompasses both of those. And the approach to treating autistic enterocolitis involves both of those as well.
Now,
can I just say for the record, apparently the quotation you just read from is on page 680 rather than 679.
Oh, thank you for that.
Is that correct?
Okay. Yes.
All right. Go ahead.
in May of 2005, were you treating Michelle as if she had Crohn's disease?
Again, it was from a treatment standpoint, it makes no difference in my mind what you call it, because whether it's Crohn's disease or indeterminate colitis or cystic enterocolitis, the treatment would be the same. My approach would be the same.
The same medications.
Same medications. And same. I didn't mention before, the third approach you have in treating both of these diseases would be the use of drugs that affect the microbial flora content of the bowel. That's a third large category of approaching an interventional approach to treating both Crohn's disease and also, in our experience, autistic enterocolitis.
And was she receiving the same dosage as she would had she had at that time a diagnosis of Crohn's disease?
It would be the same dose, yes.
Now, Doctor, during your direct testimony, and I believe it's on one of your slides, you talk about the Feldman, Schlesinger, and Fordham's gastrointestinal and liver disease textbook. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you called it authoritative. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you also refer to a textbook called Coomer, Robbins, and Cotran.
Correct.
I'm pronouncing those right. And would you consider that authoritative?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, Doctor, you say on page 7 of your report that Michelle is an undisputed case of ASD-GI.
That's correct.
What is ASD-GI?
ASD-GI is a term that we use, we meaning the people that treat children with autism and bowel disease medically, to designate her as an ASD patient with GI problems. Not all ASD patients have GI symptoms. Not all ASD patients have enterocolitis. But there is a large subset of children with ASD, and you can argue from today till tomorrow how many they are, whether it's 20% or 70%, whatever, different papers cite different numbers. But there's clearly a substantial portion of children with ASD who have enterocolitis, GI symptoms, biopsy proven enterocolitis. ASD-GI is a designation that that we give to those patients to indicate that they're autistic, but they're the subpopulation of autistic children with gastrointestinal disease.
Is ASD-GI the same thing as autistic enterocolitis?
No, I don't think it is.
What is the difference?
In our experience, again, we have autistic enterocolitis that really describes bowel disease of the small intestine and of the colon. But ASD-GI would suggest that the disease doesn't just involve the small bowel and the colon, it may involve the stomach as well, and the esophagus as well. And there are very predictable abnormalities of both the esophagus and the stomach that we see routinely and very frequently.
If a child just had a disease of the stomach and nothing else and had autism, would that be a case of ASD-GI?
Correct.
And if a child had a disease of the esophagus and nothing else, would that be a case of ASD-GI?
Correct.
Okay.
It's more of a nomenclature. It tends to put in your mind the notion that there are gastrointestinal manifestations in this child with autism without relation to the organ, specific organ, that disease is.
Now, Doctor, in the two textbooks, the Schlesinger Fortran's gastrointestinal liver disease and the Kumar, Robbins, and Cotran that you agreed were authoritative, does the term ASD-GI appear anywhere?
No, it does not.
Does the term autistic enterocolitis appear anywhere?
No, it does not.
Now, in the last paragraph of your report on page 8, you state the following opinion. The measles, mumps, rubella vaccine Michelle received contributed significantly to her subsequent development of enterocolitis, and that it is the persistence of the virus in the lymphoid tissue of the bowel that is causing the ongoing enterocolitis. So there are two premises to your opinion. Correct me if I'm wrong. The first is you believe she suffers from enterocolitis, correct?
I do. That's correct.
And the second, you believe that the enterocolitis is caused by the persistence of measles virus from the MMR vaccine in the lymphoid tissue of her bowel, correct?
I did. That's
okay.
Correct.
Let's look at the first premise of your opinion and why you think she has enterocolitis. And I know that you went through this in your direct. First of all, what does itis mean?
Itis means inflammation.
Okay. And enteritis is inflammation of the small bowel?
That's correct.
And colitis is inflammation of the colon?
Correct.
So enterocolitis is inflammation of the large and small intestine, correct?
That's correct.
Now, for evidence that she has inflammation in the large intestine, in fact, on page 6, you state that Michelle has colitis is beyond question.
That's correct.
Okay. And for evidence that she has colitis, you cite to the January 2002 endoscopy, the September 2003 endoscopy, and the June 2006 endoscopy. Is that correct?
Show me that again. What page would that be on?
Of your report. Page 6 of your report.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, what were you quoting?
You say that Michelle has colitis is beyond question, is evidenced by colonic aphthous ulceration seen on 2 separate occasions by 2 different gastroenterologists.
I'm not, here we go. Correct, but in the question before you mentioned the...
I just want to make sure I'm understanding exactly what evidence you're relying upon for your diagnosis of colitis. And is it the report of the 2002 endoscopy?
No, it's not.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm relying on my colonoscopy in September of 2003 and the colonoscopy in 2006.
Okay. And you state on page 6 of your report that Michelle's diagnosis of enteritis is also beyond question, as evidenced by the presence of small bowel aphthous lesions. And for that, doctor, are you relying on the findings from the PILCAM from the June 2006 capsule imaging?
That's correct.
Okay. And based on these findings of colitis and enteritis, is that the basis of your opinion that she has enterocolitis? Is that correct?
That's not correct.
What is the basis of your opinion that she has enterocolitis?
That is a portion of my opinion. My opinion is based upon the presence of aphthous ulcerations in the small bowel, in the colon, in a manner and fashion which has been described to exist in Crohn's disease. Small bowel in particular, in the presence of a history of abdominal pain and vomiting, in the presence of a physical exam that shows uveitis and arthritis, in the presence of elevated sedimentation rates, C-reactive protein, thrombocytosis, an elevated OMP-C test, and with the clinical response to anti-inflammatory medications that you would expect for someone who has an enterocolitis. So the constellation of those observations leads me to conclude beyond any doubt that this is her diagnosis.
Doctor, if the facts were different and there was no uveitis and no arthritis, would your opinion be the same?
That's a hypothetical question, and I'm not sure. It depends on the overall scenario.
The overall scenario is exactly the same. I'm just taking out the uveitis and the arthritis. Would your opinion that she has enterocolitis be the same?
It's a difficult question to answer.
So you don't know?
I don't know, right. The diagnosis of Crohn's disease is really is often based on a combination of clinical criteria. Unless you're fortunate enough to have a specific finding, like a stenosis of the small bowel or a fistula or a granuloma, unless you have that, it's often difficult to be certain that Crohn's disease is a diagnosis. That's why the utility of the serologic markers, this OMP-C that I referred to, was such a great advance in helping us diagnose Crohn's disease and also distinguish it from ulcerative colitis, which has different markers that are associated with it. So really the diagnosis does not rest on one or two findings. It's really a constellation of the presenting signs and symptoms and labs, and chop off one and say, would you still feel the same way, is really hypothetical.
Just so I'm clear, are you equating can one have enterocolitis and not have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis?
Absolutely.
Now, Doctor, let's look at the second premise of your opinion, that measles virus from the MMR vaccine Michelle received is persisting in the lymphoid tissue of her bowel and causing enterocolitis. Doctor, do you have an opinion as to why the measles virus is persisting in the lymphoid tissue of her bowel?
I don't have an opinion. I have suspicions based upon published reports, and it's not my area of expertise. I haven't formed an opinion yet, but I suspect that it's due, the weight of the literature, as reviewed by Ashwood, I mentioned that before, suggests that there's a skewed inflammatory response in favor of pro-inflammatory cytokines versus cytokines that are counter-inflammatory. That seems to be the overall pattern in a number of publications. That seems to be a consistent finding. The exact levels of cytokines and which ones, and it may differ from study to study, but that seems to be the overall pattern. So I suspect that, if you ask me about my suspect, it has to do with a patient's innate immune activity.
Doctor, you're not an immunologist, though, correct?
I am not.
Now, are you saying, though, that you suspect that she had a dysregulated immune system at the time she received her MMR vaccine?
In response to your question, that's my suspicion, what I believe.
And do you have an opinion as to why she had a dysregulated immune system at the time of her MMR vaccine?
That I don't know.
Now, in support of your opinion that Michelle has persistent measles virus in the lymphoid tissue of her bowel, you cite to the positive finding in 2002 by the Unigenetics Lab in Dublin, Ireland, of measles RNA in the tissue sample tested in Michelle, correct?
Well, by the published report, correct, of their findings.
But from Unigenetics, specific to Michelle.
Right.
Doctor, if these tests from Unigenetics were shown to not be reliable, would your opinion still be the same?
If they were shown, demonstrated, not be reliable, my opinion today would still be the same because we seem to be mounting our own evidence with the specimens that I've obtained. And that we've shown in at least six patients that with autism, with bowel symptoms, who underwent a diagnostic endoscopy looking for enterocolitis, most of whom had diagnosed enterocolitis on biopsy, we found, using a different lab and different investigators, in at least six of them, that there's vaccine strain measles virus genome. So, in my mind, there's been at least preliminary confirmation of that report. So, even if you were to tell me that with absolute certainty that the findings of the lab in Dublin were erroneous, I still would tend to believe in our own experience and preliminary evidence anyway, that there is virus there. We know it's there, at least some of the kids.
So then I take it from your opinion that if no test had been done at all, so we don't have evidence either way, would that affect your opinion?
If there's no evidence either way, that would definitely affect my opinion.
And how would that affect your opinion?
There's no evidence, and I tend to avoid making an opinion.
So if Michelle's tissue had never been sent to any laboratory, your opinion that she has persistent measles virus in her bowel would be different?
I wouldn't know with certainty. You know, if just to respond to your question, if I knew that the published reports describing measles virus were accurate, and in response to your question, Michelle never had a biopsy or tested for measles virus, I could reasonably hypothesize, well, the other clinical characteristics of this patient are identical to those patients who were subsequently confirmed to have measles virus, so I would certainly be open to that possibility.
Doctor, assume the facts are the exact same as this case, but Michelle was shown not to have inflammation in her bowel, no inflammation, but she has GI symptoms. Would you still be of the opinion that she has ASD GI?
She has no inflammation. So if every test that we know of to do failed to demonstrate inflammation, that's the question?
Yes, it's the question.
Then I would consider I would consider giving her a trial of an anti-inflammatory. And if she responded the way you'd expect the patient would respond with inflammation to an anti-inflammatory, then I could reasonably conclude that it is there, I just haven't seen it.
What if the facts of this case are the same, except she never underwent an endoscopy, but everything else is the same? Would you still think that she had ASDGI?
Again, there's too many Fs, you know. It's what if she were, you know, had two heads?
It's not too many. I mean, the facts of the case are exactly the same. It's just she had never undergone any of her five endoscopies. Would you still think she had ASDGI?
I might have to give that some serious thought.
So you don't know?
I don't know.
Now, Doctor, on the last page of your report, you list the relevant facts to you in this case. In the first one, you state that the relevant facts of Michelle's history are, one, the appearance of classic ASDGI disease, together with other signs of systemic illness closely following, within 7 days, the administration of the MMR vaccine. So if I'm understanding, Doctor, are you saying that a significant fact for your opinion that the MMR vaccine caused Michelle's enterocolitis is that Michelle had symptoms of systemic illness within 7 days of her MMR vaccine?
No, that's a misquote. What I'm saying in this is that the appearance of her ASDGI symptoms, the symptoms made their appearance, and time has shown that they were chronic. They never really remitted. She's had GI symptoms from the very onset period.
What symptoms are you referring to?
Well, she had vomiting and diarrhea. The vomiting improved, diarrhea reverted to constipation. At that point, it went back to being diarrhea, and it's remained diarrhea for many years. So there's never been a period of time in Michelle's history where she's been free of GI symptoms.
Is it your understanding that she had GI symptoms, the vomiting and diarrhea, 7 days after the MMR vaccination?
Within 7 to 14 days. That's the history that I got. So
Would your opinion be different if the onset of vomiting and diarrhea was 1 month later?
No, not 1 month.
What about 2 months?
I would say 6 months, and let me explain myself. This question I will answer, even though it's hypothetical, because in our experience, we've seen many cases of children with autistic enterocolitis who've been biopsied and confirmed their biopsy to have it, who, when you get a careful history from the parents, the GI symptoms don't appear until many months after MMR. Even if there was even in those cases who had a regression immediately after MMR, some of them don't manifest the symptoms, like the diarrhea, until months after that. So it's been our experience that And all we can rely on is the symptom presentation. You can't know what's in there, obviously. So that's why I would answer you that if the appearance of GI symptoms occurred as late as 4 to 6 months afterwards, I still would consider it related.
Anything after six months, though, you would consider unrelated to the MMR vaccine?
No, we have kids even after 6 months.
Well, what's your limit? I mean, you just said 6 months. Would it be 7 months?
We see, again, this has to do with we haven't quantified it, so I can't give you an exact number, but in my experience, thinking back over all the cases we've seen, that's how I'm going to be answering your question, is that the majority of them, of the children who ultimately are diagnosed with enterocolitis on biopsy, majority of them have presented with GI symptoms within 6 months of their MMR. This is an opinion, because you've asked me for one. I can't cite the data. But I also know from our experience that the onset of GI symptoms in many of the children with classic regressive autism occurred even over a year after the onset of their regression. So that's a lot. There's a lot about the bowel disease that we don't understand.
So from my understanding, if Michelle's diarrhea and vomiting occurred 1 year post-MMR, would your opinion be different?
Opinion of what?
That the MMR vaccine caused her enterocolitis.
No, not if we found the virus there.
But I thought you just said that it's not necessary to find measles virus. Whether or not there was a positive finding of measles virus is not a necessary part of your opinion. You said that it didn't matter to you if the results from the Unigenetics lab were found to be unreliable.
That's not what I said.
What did you say?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, but...
I asked you a question that if it was shown that the results from the Unigenetics lab are shown to be unreliable, would your opinion that she has persistent measles virus in her lymphoid tissue of her bowel be different? And you said no.
But we have our own experience with that. So what I said was that I would strongly suspect, based upon our experience, that that's what caused it. And, you asked me if I would know that for certain. The answer is no, because without getting a result on Michelle, and your question was hypothetical, where there was no Unigenetics result, but I still think she had it, I couldn't know that she had it unless I had a result.
So it is... So a positive finding of measles virus is a necessary component of measles virus RNA in the bowel, the lymphoid tissue of the bowel, is a necessary component of your opinion that a child has persistent measles virus due to the MMR vaccine.
That's correct.
Now, Doctor, at the end of your testimony, you were referring to a poster presentation that was presented at the MFAR conference in 2006. And I'm referring to Petitions Exhibit 59 at Tab K. And you described it as a study that you're doing with Dr. Stephen Walker and Dr. Karen Heppner. And who is the other?
Dr. Jeff Siegel.
Dr. Jeff Siegel. Now, this is presented on the poster preliminary data, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And this is not a blinded study, is it?
No, this work was not blinded.
Okay. Are you still in the data collection phase?
We are.
Okay. Doctor, who funds the study?
This study is funded by a variety of sources. As best as I recall, there was money that came from the Autism Research Institute. There was some private funding from individuals, and there was a private funding from also a private foundation.
Do you have an autism expert on the study?
An autism expert?
Somebody who...
You mean like a neurologist?
A neurologist?
We have no neurologist involved in the study. We have no psychiatrist involved in the study.
Do you have someone who can verify the diagnosis of regressive autism?
They've all been seen. They've all been evaluated.
Mm-hmm. Do all the children in the study have a diagnosis of regressive autism?
No. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I don't know if these kids were all regressive or if these kids were just autistic.
How do you select the kids that participate in the study?
Well, basically, it's just the kids who presented for an endoscopy, a colonoscopy, so based upon their GI symptoms, or we obtained biopsies of the ileum.
Presented to you, or do other people contribute tissue samples to the study?
No, these are all patients that were biopsied by me.
By you. Okay. Did you charge them for the endoscopies?
For the end, yeah, sure. We did not charge them for any research-related costs, so whatever costs are involved to process the specimens for the research or to test them is not billed to the patient. They're only billed for that portion of the endoscopy which is clinically indicated.
What's the sample size?
We have over 275 specimens that are banked and have been preserved properly. So that's the potential pool, and that was indicated in the poster.
Have you submitted any this at all for publication yet?
I mentioned before, still in the data gathering process.
Now, Doctor, were you at the MFAR conference in 2006?
No, I was not there.
Okay. So this poster was presented not by you, correct?
Correct. Dr. Steve Walker was there.
Okay. Now, do you know, though, Doctor, that right next to your poster at the MFAR conference in 2006, there was a poster contradicting your findings?
I had heard that, yes.
And that was from Dr. D'Souza, Fombone, and Ward?
Correct. It didn't quite contradict the findings that I said. That's a misstatement.
Well, they've since published the results of their study in pediatrics, correct?
That's correct.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
All right. Let me take a look and see if I have any questions that weren't asked, if you bear with me for a moment, Doctor. Did I hear you, Doctor, talk about the Teresa Cedillo's difficulty in finding a pediatric gastroenterologist close enough to treat Michelle?
Close enough, yeah.
Right. As I understood her testimony, there was no pediatric gastroenterologist in Yuma.
Correct.
And that was part of the reason she ended up seeing you. But did I recall that you were helping her to try to get somebody closer to home than New York City?
I spent hours on the phone coordinating Michelle's care, not just with other gastroenterologists, but with the rheumatologist and the ophthalmologist and the pediatricians and the radiologist, and put a lot of time and effort into making sure that Michelle got to the people that were able to help her.
And refresh my memory, you testified, I think, to helping her get in touch with a treating pediatric gastroenterologist who was closer.
That's correct.
Somewhere in California, I think.
That's where she's ended up.
Can you tell me who that was?
David Ziering at UCLA.
That was the one in Los Angeles. All right. Now, I'm just curious how my geography isn't that good, but I would think that Phoenix or San Diego would be a lot closer than Los Angeles. Were there nobody in those areas that would be qualified?
That's more of a question for Teresa.
Okay.
She would tell me who she wanted to go see based upon her insurance plan and mm-hmm. based upon a person's. She would research before she ever sees anyone. She researches them, as you may have understood that from hearing her talk. And so she would look for people with an academic background in inflammatory bowel disease and a track record of an inquisitive mind, and that those are the ones who she singled out and pursued them.
Okay, bear with me a minute. Well, I think all the questions I was going to ask have been asked by one counselor or the other. Any of the special masters?
I do. I have a couple of questions. Dr. Kriegsman, just a couple of questions I have regarding your poster presentation. For the record, this is Special Master Campbell Smith. You indicated that you're not certain whether the study just was restricted to kids with regressive autism or if it were a broader set of autistic kids.
I have to check with Dr. Walker about that.
Okay.
I seem to recall it was limited just to regressive autism, but I don't want to say that with certainty.
That point of clarification would be appreciated.
Okay, certainly.
Of all the kids that were included in the study, you indicated that they all had GI problems, including there was a reference to the four post-mortem specimens were ones that had GI problems as well.
Post-mortem specimens?
They're in your... In the larger, let's see. I'm referring to the paper presentation at page 9. This is
the poster.
The controls.
Yes, your controls. I'm sorry. This is at, for the record, I'm referring to petitioner's Trial Exhibit 3 at page 9, you indicated that you currently have 15 non-autistic pediatric controls, four of which were post-mortem specimens of non-autistic children. Did those specimens, were they associated with children who had GI problems?
No, they were not. The four post-mortem specimens were obtained from a government program called the CHTN, the acronym. And I forget what the C stands for, but HTN is Human Tissue Network, and it's a program you apply for with a formal application. And there are participating hospitals that, based upon, and you specify what you want, what kind of tissue, how you want it preserved, how you want it processed, how you want it sent, where you want it sent to. And when a patient expires at a participating hospital, they then go and they harvest the organ that you requested, send it to you for research purposes. So cooperative Human Tissue Network. So we received four post-mortem specimens from them. That's what that's referring to.
Okay, and they were non-autistic and did not have GI problems.
That's correct.
Okay. Another matter, you indicated that it did make some difference to you regarding the onset of gastrointestinal problems after the receipt of the MMR vaccination. 6 months was, outside of 6 months, longer than 6 months, was in your view perhaps too long.
I didn't quite say that. I said most of the kids, in just thinking back of our experience, we haven't quantified that data and looked at that question specifically, but a lot of parents ask me this question, so I've thought about it. And our experience with, you know, with many hundreds of these children, the majority of them have an onset of their GI symptoms within 6 months of their regression. So to say it was the 6 months of MMR may actually be inaccurate. When I ask the question, I don't really ask, you know, how in relation to MMR did the GI symptoms present themselves. My real interest is in terms of the regression. Whether the GI symptoms precede the regression, that is the time that the parents in retrospect note that the child has lost milestones. Did the GI symptoms precede that period? Did it occur at about the same time, or did it occur after the regression? That's the question I really ask all patients. I don't ask what the chronologic association was between the MMR vaccine and the GI symptoms. And when I ask parents about correlation between onset of regression and onset of GI symptoms, most parents will say that the GI symptoms occurred within 6 months of the time that they noted that their child has regressed. That's what I say. But as I mentioned, that's most of them. There are a number that have GI symptoms presenting a year later or over a year later.
Is that something you're tracking in this, with respect to your ongoing study?
Yeah, we have that data. We have it entered. We have a very detailed database that's in the process of being improved even further. We get very specific histories from our patients, specifically for this purpose.
Is that primarily from parents, or is that from physicians as well?
It's all parents. I mean, our experience has been that when it comes to these symptoms, the parents are the most reliable source of information.
Dr. Kriegsman, there was an issue that you declined to want to address earlier during your direct examination, and that was the occurrence of lymphonodular hyperplasia, whether or not that's a normal finding in your experience as a pediatric gastroenterologist. I've read quite a bit of submitted material that seems to suggest that this phenomenon can occur, or there's a correlation between the number of invasive techniques, endoscopies, colonoscopies, that have been administered. Do you have a view?
Oh yeah, I have a very very strong view about that. Lymphoid hyperplasia is is the response of the immune system to something. So it's a response, the lymphoid nodule, the germinal center starts replicating, the B cells are being produced, and there's a swelling that you can see visibly. So it's an immune response. So it always means something. So the question is whether it's a pathological process that needs to be treated, or does it indicate disease? And that's an entirely different question. So yes, in the course of day-to-day living, a child might ingest something or become transiently ill with a virus that clears after a week or two, and he may be left with residual small lymphoid hyperplasia, which clearly is not, it's not normal, it's a response to something, but it's not pathologic. We don't need to address it or deal with it. And on the other hand, there are certainly a number of disease conditions that the hyperplasia is an integral part of. So if you take a look at a patient with C. difficile colitis, you'll find marked LNH. If you look at patients with H. pylori gastritis, you'll find marked LNH. If you look at a patient with Crohn's disease, you find marked LNH. So these are all characteristic features of many disease processes. A lot of the immunodeficiency states, HIV, enteritis also, is accompanied by lymphoplasia of the small bowel and then the colon. So it clearly is part of a pathologic process in many, many diseases. Now, whether it's always pathologic is a matter of debate. As I say, it always means there's been an immune response. That's for sure. But whether it means that there's disease, it's a different question. And the answer, I believe, is no. So having LNH in and of itself in a patient who otherwise is healthy and well is not indicative of anything other than that lymphoid nodules once upon a time saw something and responded to it. And that something may or may not still be present. But to therefore say that all LNH is therefore normal is grossly incorrect, since it's well described as being part and parcel of the description of so many diseases. And in our experience with these children, what convinces me that the LNH is part of the pathologic process is that I theorized that if LNH occurs in association with inflammation of the colon, you can show a statistical correlation between them that would be significant. That suggests that the LNH is not occurring in the absence of any other finding, but in the presence of inflammation. And that suggests that the process is pathologic. And we have that data, we have made that calculation. We reviewed well over 100 patients, and one of the analyses that we did was looking for a statistical correlation between the LNH and the inflammation, and we found that patients with LNH were more likely to have inflammation than those without LNH. So that's in already in manuscript form that has not been completed yet. So to answer your question,
Pardon me, Dr. Kriegsman, the early manuscript form, is this another paper distinct from your poster presentation?
Correct. Yeah, this is a separate analysis that myself and other authors in collaboration have done as a review, as a retrospective review of our experience with our first large number of patients.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, Doctor, mm-hmm. retrospective review, are you looking at case control study?
No, it's simply a large number of patients, and we reviewed our findings and report. So we had X number of patients. What did we find in them? Report.
And so you're comparing the findings, inflammation versus the endoscopy findings versus normal statistical. I'm not sure I understand what you're comparing.
Not even that.
So it's not a comparison.
It's strictly a report. This is what we did in X number of patients. This is what we found, and the results. You know, it's without a control, without being prospective. It puts certain limitations on the value of that study, and that's understood. But a retrospective review of this group of kids in a large number will stand on its own, just as a very important piece of information towards the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. we don't commonly perform endoscopies on kids without GI symptoms, correct?
Never should.
Thank you.
One follow-up question. LNH can occur in the absence of a persistent irritant, a persistent virus.
Yes.
You alluded to something that is transient that moves through the system.
Yes. Yeah,
as a matter of fact, correct me if I'm wrong, in kids with food allergies, for example, does the LNH resolve once the kids stop with the particular foods?
I don't know if anyone's looked at that in particular to see whether food allergy-induced LNH resolves over time. I'm not aware of a paper that looked specifically at that, but I'll tell you, from other areas of the body, any of your lymph nodes, if you have a sore throat and you get a swollen gland, even when you feel better a week later, that swollen gland could be present for months and months and months, and particularly in kids, you know. Kids have their persistent tonsils are lymphoid tissue also. And even in the absence of any ongoing inflammation, tonsils are often very large in children. Not considered pathologic, but it's the residual hypertrophy of lymphoid tissue, which sometimes persists even after the inciting agent disappears.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kriegsman.
Dr. Kriegsman, I'd like to ask another question as well. I'm concerning your ongoing study that is at tab K of the articles in your report, and that where you gave us a copy of the poster for it today. I'm referring to that study. From the quick looking at tab K, it mentions that biopsy tissue was assayed by the RT-PCR for the presence of measles virus RNA. Now, to that extent, it sounds very much to me like what the Unigenetics lab did. Is it the same assays we're talking about? The same assay?
My answer to that would be yes, but I really would defer that question for Dr. Heppner tomorrow, because she would have much more specific. I don't want to answer incorrectly.
Maybe that's really my next question then. I was in the case of the ones at Unigenetics, we're talking about a specific lab. Usually when I see these kind of results, these kind of assays done in cases, it's usually reported by such and such lab. So is it Dr. Heppner's lab lab was doing?
No, it's Wake Forest University.
It is Wake Forest
University. Dr. Steve Walker is a molecular biologist over there. It's his lab.
It's his lab.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the specifics of the assay, Steve used a number of different primers, so he was experimenting with a lot of to see which ones would be most productive versus least productive, that's demonstrated in the table. And again, Dr. Heppner could give you much more detail about that. So more primers were used in our study than in the Element study.
All right, that answers my question. Any redirect for this witness? Let's take a 5-minute break. Don't forget that we're going to go dark here, and we want to get out before that happens. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. Thank you.
assumptions that you know you bought from the program. I said, what other book?
All right, for those folks who are at home, we're back from our break here, and Ms. Chin Kaplan for the petitioners will be asking some more questions of Dr. Krigsman. Ms. Chin Kaplan, please go ahead.
Thank you, Special Master. Dr. Kriegsman, are you aware that Michelle Cedillo is now receiving Humira?
I am.
What is Humira?
Humira is a more recently manufactured anti-TNF drug, which has a lower side effect profile than Remicade, which preceded it, for a variety of reasons. And she is now receiving that.
And what are the indications for the use of Humira?
Well, autoimmune diseases that involve tumor necrosis factor as the as a predominant cytokine would all be expected to respond to Humira. So diseases such as severe arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, or and inflammatory bowel disease are two immediate diagnoses that come to mind that would be expected to respond to Humira, based upon their known predilection for tumor necrosis factor.
Did you order the Humira?
No, I did not. Dr. Ziering at UCLA, the pediatric gastroenterologist over there, ordered Humira. Not at my urging. I have not spoken with Dr. Ziering, nor have I ever emailed him or he emailed me.
And Dr. Ziering is Michelle Cedillo's current treating pediatric gastroenterologist?
That's correct.
Doc, before we leave that topic, can you spell the name of that medication for us?
H-U-M-I-R-A.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Jim Kappa.
Thank you. Doctor, you were asked some questions about a situation that occurred at Lenox Hill Hospital. Do you remember those questions?
I do.
Doctor, could you kindly tell the court the circumstances of what occurred at Lenox Hill Hospital?
Oh, it's a long story, but the essentials of the story is that the hospital was concerned that the endoscopies that I was performing on children with autism and bowel symptoms, very similar to Michelle's history, same kind of diarrhea, same abdominal pain, they were concerned that those procedures were not medically indicated and were being performed for the purpose of research. And that was their concern. And in response to that concern, they prevented me from performing further endoscopies in the endoscopy unit. And that resulted in litigation.
Hey, Doctor, when you perform an endoscopy, are there clinical signs and symptoms which you rely upon before you would conduct that procedure?
Absolutely. You know, the standard textbook indications, pediatric GI textbook indications for a diagnostic colonoscopy, for example, is a presence of abdominal pain that's chronic, with or without diarrhea, chronic diarrhea with or without abdominal pain. Those two findings, when there's no other explainable cause, so you've looked at potential diagnoses and ruled them out based upon either laboratory testing, which includes blood and stool. If you ruled out other diagnoses based upon the history and physical examination, if you ruled out everything you can think of and what's left is abdominal pain and diarrhea, then the next step is a diagnostic colonoscopy specifically to look for inflammatory changes as being the cause of the abdominal pain and diarrhea. What makes these children different from most other kids that I previously encountered in my career as a pediatric gastroenterologist is that traditionally, and this is part of the confusion, traditionally, the way we're taught, whether it's taught explicitly or just implied, is that the chances of having bowel inflammation that result in symptoms is unlikely if there's no bleeding or weight loss. This is something that most answer, and this is something that I was taught and I believed for quite a long time. And so in the absence of any evidence of bleeding, either visible bleeding or microscopic bleeding or weight loss or low albumin or high sed rate, in the absence of any one of those findings, if you have chronic diarrhea and abdominal pain, you're very unlikely to find bowel inflammation as the cause of a diarrhea and abdominal pain. And that way of thinking is a prevailing way of thinking, and it's even supported by a number of studies. It isn't just like it's a myth. But these children have been shown to be different. These children have inflammation that is related to their symptoms, but usually it occurs, these symptoms of diarrhea and pain occur in the absence of gross bleeding, invisible bleeding, in the absence of even microscopic bleeding, usually. There are some kids who have bleeding, but most of them don't. Most of the kids don't have an elevated set rate, even though Michelle did. And these children, again, have been demonstrated, and this has been published, to have enterocolitis, even though they didn't have the other markers that traditionally gastroenterologists have relied on in determining whether we're likely to find colitis, which is a cause of their symptoms. So that's the way of thinking, and this was the concern of the hospital that they therefore concluded that I must be doing this for research-related reasons, meaning that these children did not, in fact, merit a diagnostic colonoscopy. I was just interested in some research project, and they moved to, and they did, they prevented me from scheduling any further colonoscopies. I should mention that these children that I had scoped, and by the way, it was at Lenox Hill, I should mention that it wasn't until after I had scoped more than 100 children there, more than 100 children were scoped at that hospital, that they moved to prevent me from doing further colonoscopies. And the pathologists at the hospital, and there were many of them, a variety of pathologists would read the biopsies. It wasn't just one or two. The frequency with which the hospital's pathologists found this nonspecific enterocolitis was close to 70%. So the majority of the children there, and these are all part of the medical records of these children. It's not my diagnosis. This is institutional pathologist diagnosis. And despite that, there was still this concern of the hospital that this is something that's different, that they wanted stopped. And that's the story.
So, Doctor, the children that you wanted to scope, they all had GI symptoms? Is that true?
Every single one. Every single patient who gets a diagnostic colonoscopy, which is what these kids are getting, have chronic symptoms in the absence of an explainable cause.
And all other causes have been ruled out, is that true?
Yeah, we routinely will do blood testing, stool testing, abdominal x-rays, dietary investigations, dietary changes, urine analysis, looking for urine infections. I mean, the common causes of pediatric GI symptoms are all ruled out. And when that happens and the symptoms persist, and they impact the patient's quality of life, the next step is to do a diagnostic colonoscopy looking specifically for bowel inflammation. And that approach, by the way, has been now adopted by a consensus of pediatric gastroenterologists since the Lenox Hill incident, specifically in October of 2006. There was a meeting of leading pediatric gastroenterologists, and I attended, even though I'm not a leading pediatric GI doctor. I was invited to attend and be part of this meeting, and it was held in Boston at the Harvard Club and attended by a number of very prominent pediatric gastroenterologists from this country. And the purpose of the meeting was convened by Autism Speaks. It's an organization that many of you probably have heard of. And it was convened by them. Information about this is available on their website, specifically to respond to the community interest, is the way the website phrases it. This parental concern that so many of these children are experiencing gastrointestinal problems, and you know, what approach does a panel of leading gastroenterologists recommend be taken to assess and evaluate these patients? And between October and I think January, February, the the statement went back and forth amongst the various authors, and eventually the consensus statement was published on the Autism Speaks website, and it's available. We'll be happy to distribute it to the court. And it essentially advocates the exact workup that I've just described to you. You know, careful history, careful physical exam. You can treat empirically for minor problems. Constipation, treat it the way you normally would treat constipation. A little diarrhea, you can try giving some motility drugs temporarily. Rule out other causes, other potential causes of these symptoms in these children. But after you've done that, if all those tests are negative, and you've done empiric short-term therapy for, you know, for irritable bowel syndrome and for constipation, and despite all those things, the problem still persists, then the next step is to look specifically for inflammatory changes at the colon. So that's becoming more of a consensus opinion. I'm happy to say that.
Now, Doctor, you mentioned that that meeting took place in Boston in October of 2006?
Correct.
And was there a sponsoring organization?
Autism Speaks sponsored it.
Special Master? Doctor, I'm going to ask you to read along with me, please. Is this the letterhead of Autism Speaks?
Correct, it is.
And Doctor, is the title of this document Autism Speaks Hosts Gastroenterology Workshop?
Yes, it is.
And Doctor, underneath this, does it say, responding to community interest, Autism Speaks hosted a workshop on autism and gastroenterology in Boston on October 13, 2006. The objective of the workshop were to, one, review current scientific evidence for GI issues associated with autism, two, develop consensus scientific priorities for autism gastroenterology research, and three, suggest an approach to establish best clinical practices for autism gastroenterology. Have I read that correctly?
Verbatim.
In an effort to capture all perspectives on this topic, participants included members of the Autism Speaks Scientific Affairs Committee and leading experts on pediatric gastroenterology and autism. The discussion was comprehensive and productive. Please watch this space for a synopsis of the consensus recommendation. Have I read that correctly?
Yes.
And Doctor, underneath it, it listed the participants in this gastroenterology workshop, didn't it?
It did.
And Doctor, was Dr. Paul Ashwood of the University of California Davis Mind Institute present?
Yes, he was.
Dr. Federico Balzoa, Hospital Molinet from Torino, Italy?
Correct, he was.
Dr. Margaret Bauman, the Ladders Clinic from Boston.
Correct.
Ms. Shinkappen, should we, rather than read the list, should we just make this petitioner's trial exhibit 5? I mean, you're going to read this whole list of...
I thought it would, that this was a consensus meeting of experts within the field, and
okay,
these were the people who participated.
All right.
So I thought we should be comprehensive on this.
Well, what I'm saying is, can we get this into the record just by making it a trial exhibit?
Oh, certainly.
Is it?
Certainly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Trial exhibit 5, right.
Would this be Kriegsman?
Well, no. You were mentioning us to the other ones, Kriegsman. Let's call them petitioners' trial exhibits 1, 2, 3, 4, and now number 5.
Okay.
So with, I was just saying, this list speaks for itself. It tells, gives the names you're reading off and their, who they're from. So, but
thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Thank you, Special Master. Dr. Timothy Bowie, Massachusetts General Hospital for Children, Boston. Dr. David Burnham, PediaMed Pharmaceuticals, Florence, Kentucky. Dr. Stan Cohen, Emory College, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Andrew Conrad, National Genetics Institute, Los Angeles, California. Dr. Anil, is that it? Dabari, Kennedy Krieger Institute, Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Gary Goldstein, Kennedy Krieger Institute, Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Susan Hyman, University of Rochester Medical Center, Rochester, New York. Dr. Arthur Kriegsman, that's you, right? Dr. Alan N. Leitner, Children's Hospital, Boston. Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, Advocates for Children, Lynchburg, Virginia. Dr. Leonard Rappaport, Children's Hospital, Boston. Dr. Ann Reynolds, University of Colorado, Denver, the Children's Hospital. Dr. Mark Rothmeyer, Autism Speaks, New York. Dr. Andy Shee, Autism Speaks, New York. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Thoughtful House for Children, Austin, Texas. Dr. Alan Walker, Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. Have I read the list, Doctor?
Yes.
And, Doctor, this indicates that there was going to be a consensus recommendation. Is that true?
That's correct.
And was that consensus recommendation issued?
Yes, it was, and it was available on their website. More importantly, it was mailed to all the pediatricians that are members of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
And should we mark this as petitioner's exhibit?
Trial exhibit number 6. Right.
Doctor, I'm not going to go through this because it's quite a lengthy document. It's 7 pages long, am I correct?
Correct.
And since you were the participant there, did you review the subsequent drafts?
Subsequent drafts, yeah, they were passed around as they evolved.
And did you review this final, the finalized version?
Yes, I did.
And it's a Dear Doctor letter, is that it?
Correct.
And what's your understanding of its distribution?
I'm sorry?
What's your understanding of its distribution?
Well, as I mentioned, it was mailed out to all pediatricians, actually all members of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
And, Doctor, since you had reviewed the final version of this, could you just summarize for the court what is contained within this Dear Doctor letter?
Well, basically, it's a recommended approach to children who have gastrointestinal symptoms, and it describes the introduction, goes through some of the published data that suggests the varying frequencies with which GI symptoms are found. The second page goes through the pertinent components of the history that the panel felt would be most suggestive or most likely to make any sort of a diagnosis, not just colitis, but towards reflux and constipation. These children, and make no mistake, I'm not saying that every child with autism and GI symptoms is enteric colitis. That should not be the way you're interpreting what I'm saying today. Children with autism have a whole gamut of gastrointestinal diagnoses, including enteric colitis. And the main import of this meeting was to emphasize that their symptoms, which may be not like symptoms that we're used to seeing in children because of their communicative disorders, need to be taken seriously. So, what questions need to be asked? What labs need to be drawn? What, if any, X-rays need to be done? What specific workup should be done depending on the symptom presentation, and three main symptoms are diarrhea, constipation, and bloating, what parts of the history would suggest that in a child with ASD, what part of the physical examination would be most pertinent to pursue, depending on the symptom. And recommendations for empiric treating, brief empiric treatments are made. Recommendations are made when to refer to a pediatric gastroenterologist. There's a clear statement that endoscopy and colonoscopy may be indicated to make the diagnosis of a variety of different diseases, among them the colitis that has been published and described in these patients.
And doctor, this statement was the basis, was a consensus statement of the individuals who were present in this meeting?
That's correct.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Any more questions for this witness? All right. Before we break, let's do one more housekeeping task. There were two of the documents that were used in cross-examination of Dr. Crisby. Most of them, most of them had already been filed. There were two documents. One was a page or two from the Thoughtful House website. The second was the Licensure Board of Texas, the minutes of that. Should we make those two as respondents, trial exhibits 1 and 2, to put them in the record since we discussed them today?
I leave that to your discretion, sir.
Okay.
We were planning on doing a cross-examination. We did have documents, so we asked the questions first.
Any objection to that? Okay. Why don't you do that? Since we discussed them, then we can see the whole document. These all can be filed after the trial, but if you keep a list of them, and mark those number 1 and number 2 then for the respondent. Anything else that we should? Anything?
I just have one more. Dr. Kriegsman, what percentage of the patients that you currently see are non-autistic?
Very few.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else we should take care of today before we break?
Not competition.
Okay.
No response.
All right. And for the benefit of anyone listening out there, I understand that the order of business tomorrow, we'll hear from Dr. Heppner and Dr. Kennedy tomorrow for the petitioners.
That's right.
All right. With that, we're adjourned for the day. Thank you all.